radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
All right, welcome to Firehouse Podcast Live from Firehouse World 2010 in San Diego. Today, we're going to be talking about initial command success in the first moments of the firefight. We're very fortunate today to have a panel of experts from throughout the United States to be helping us with this podcast. My name's Ed Hadfield. I'm a Firetown training specialist. And to my left, I have Anthony Castros from SAC Metro Fire, battalion chief. Anthony, what battalion do you run?
Battalion 7.
Battalion 7. Great. Outstanding. We also have Captain Tim Linke from the Lincoln Fire Department in Nebraska, all the way out from Nebraska. How you doing, Tim?
Wonderful. Great to be here. I didn't bring any snow with me, so I'm doing pretty well.
Perfect. Perfect. You didn't bring a tan either, we noticed.
No, I apologize right. for that, but this is shorts weather here.
That's it. To my right is Lieutenant Todd Wernett from the Seattle Fire Department. And Todd is assigned to the Downtown Truck Company, and that is Truck 4, right, Todd?
Ladder 4, Belltown.
Ladder 4, great. And wrapping out the group is retired Captain Wes Kitchell, recently retired from Santa Rosa Fire Department. Wes, how you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me here, Ed.
Good, good. We are very excited. Well, guys, we are here to talk about initial command, success in the first moments of the firefight. And I'm going to start it off, and I'm actually going to go to Anthony on this one because he and I have had a lot of conversations. And initial command is pretty hot topic right now, especially in California, because when I think of command, I think ICS, Fire Scope.
Yep.
Chief Ray Picard and the guys that put that together. Why don't you tell me a little bit about your thoughts, and then we're going to go to the group on initial command in the first moments of the firefight.
Thanks, Ed. I do have a lot of thoughts on this, pretty passionate about it. When we talk about Firescope, we have to remember Firescope was developed for the Wildland Arena. However, and because of that, I think a lot of people try ICS on for size in the structural arena. And they say, you know, this doesn't work. It's just, this is ridiculous. We don't need it. It's box check firefighting. You don't need to set up ICS. You just need an incident commander. Let's just get the work done. Let's just put the freaking fire out, okay? Get over it. And I think what that does is that's kind of short-sighted. And I think what happens is we maybe try it on for size. We don't really train on it that much. We might get paid some lip service. We try it once or twice, and we say, you know what? We tried it. It didn't work. And like most firefighters, if they have a tool that they tried and didn't work, they throw it away. And I think ICS, in the structural arena, that's what's happened. In our system, we have a command training center, CTC, that we've developed, and it's modeled after the Phoenix Fire Department, CTC, thanks to Chief Brunicini, John Nick, and Don Abbott. And what we look at when we look at ICS, we have to put it in context. The foundation of any fire ground operation is tactics and strategy. That's what's going to put the fire out. I think we all agree that ICS doesn't put the fire out. But tactics and strategy is the foundation. We've created what we call our operational triangle up in our system. The foundation of the triangle, the bottom side, is tactics and strategy. Line placement, proper flow, vent enter search, search operations, good vertical ventilation, you know, reading the building, critical fire ground functions, etc. The next triangle is our SOGs. We have to be on the same playbook. The third side of the triangle is ICS. And that's where I think, again, the fire service pays it lip service. And there's really two schools of thought that I've found that are out there. And one is, you don't need ICS till you need it. In other words, I don't need to use ICS on simple, quote-unquote, bread-and-butter house fires. I don't need to use it on routine stuff. But if I need it, it's there for something that gets big and ugly and whatever. And people coin the phrase simple to complex. They love using that term. Oh, ICS is simple to complex. That's how we're going to use ICS. And that's great. The other school of thought says, let's be a little more proactive. Let's use ICS often. Let's use it from the early stages of the incident. And let's use it as a tool, not a cumbersome bureaucratic system, but a tool. And that's what we try and do. So case in point, I just got done writing an article on house fires and ICS. And I think it's a misnomer to think that a house fire is a simple event. We have 1,000 house fires a day in this country. 80% of the fires that happen are in homes or in residences. That's where we also kill most of our firefighters. It's also where most fire deaths occur. And one of the critical, if you look at the at NIOSH, we always look at the pie chart. We always see the NIOSH pie chart, and we see things like asphyxiation, getting lost, running out of air, whatever. I'm more interested in what caused the asphyxiation. What were the events that led up to getting lost, et cetera? So I use the analogy, what killed you? Was it jumping off the cliff or landing really hard? I know you're going to land. I want to know why you jumped off the cliff. And when you study the NIOSH line of duty deaths, the top five are these, in order. Number one is improper risk assessment. We're not sizing up the event properly in the beginning. We're too task-oriented. In other words, we just want to get in there, kick ass, and get out of there. And that's a good thing. But we also have to support that operation. That's where ICS comes in. Number two, command. Command is cited as one of the causes we're dying. We're dying because we don't have a proper command structure set up. And if you cross-reference that with where we're dying the most, in houses, that kind of begs the question that maybe we need to think more about ICS on a house fire. Number three is communications. If you have every single resource reporting back to command, then you're liable to have a lot of radio traffic. You're liable to have a bottleneck of communication, for example. In my system, we have up to a 10-to-1 ratio for the first arriving battalion chief. That battalion chief, me, for example, when I'm en route to a fire, we're going to have four engines, two trucks, both of whom often split into two-person teams. We have a fire medic and another battalion chief. You write that out, and that's a 10-to-1 ratio back to me. Now, I'm a knucklehead. I can't keep track of 10 resources. Drive code 3 without an aide. Look at the map. Monitor the tactical channel and the command channel. And check my MDT for updates. I'm just too much of a knucklehead. I'm a knuckle dragger. And by the time I arrive, I'm behind the power curve if I'm expecting to track 10 resources on a fire. It just ain't going to happen. So that begs the question of the next issue that's killing us is accountability. That's number four in the NIOSH top five. And the last one is lack of SOGs or failure to follow them. ICS is an SOG. It just is. It's supposed to be nationally accepted, but it ain't. But if we don't follow it, that's yet another contributing factor. Now, I'm not saying if you didn't have a food unit on your house fire or logistics set up, people are going to die. That's all I'm saying. But there's a specific way to set up ICS on a simple, quote-unquote, house fire or a structure fire that isn't cumbersome but actually does help you run a more safe, effective, and efficient operation. I hope we talk about that today.
We definitely are, and Todd's punching me in the arm here because he wants to jump on board. And real quick, I want to throw out a couple things here, and I want to talk about them later. As he talked about size up, and our good friend and probably no disrespect to you, Anthony, but probably one of the best working battalion chiefs out there, Mike Alder from San Bernardino City.
Outstanding.
He and Matt Frattis came up with dynamic risk assessment, so we want to go there.
Yep.
So that we want to talk about that. And then when you talk about checkbox firefighting, we want to go back to that, yep, looking at the presentations and facts. And,
yep,
you know, I agree, the food unit leader doesn't need to be set up on the simple house fire. And I keep waiting until they add the Camp Snoopy director because sometimes people over-ICS things to death. Todd, what's your opinions?
Well, I've taken some actually into these classes in the past, and they've been very helpful in my testing process for company officer and future promotions. And we have done some radical changes for the Seattle Fire Department in recent history. We've gone to changing all of our best practices from SOPs to best practices, not allowing the first aid engine company officer to go in on the initial attack with his company, his or her company. They stand outside. They establish command. It is not uncommon for the remainder of our first alarm, which on a residential is single family residential is four engines, two trucks. It goes on and on up to approximately 46 people. But we've had the remainder of the alarm on scene within 50 to 60 seconds after the first engine arrives. So you need to be outside. You need to establish a good system or else people will freelance and run amok.
Amen.
And it's been a huge change for a lot of senior company officers that say, that's crap. I'm going in with my company. They pay me to make those decisions, life and death, interior. Whereas I agree that it's important to have some experience inside. You need to have somebody that can control a scene with 40 to 50 people in a minute and a half. You need to make a lot of big decisions, offensive, defensive, what type of ventilation, what type of forcible entry, what type of attack, hose line size, location. And then the second in officer immediately becomes interior. So we break that down quickly from the 10 to 1
yep.
to a manageable 5 to 1 by all groups. Interior is the second company officer. You can have three companies in, you have interior. If we're going to go to the roof, you automatically go to roof division as opposed to my company ladder 4 being
right.
roof. You break it down to divisions and interior
yep.
or roof right away. And it's been pretty controversial because we are old school, traditional fire department.
It's a controversial
like
topic.
A lot of places.
Yep.
And ICS, we end up with... We have operations, and we have IC at house fires. We have a division chief that shows up and establishes incident command and takes it from the battalion chief. They become operations. The second battalion chief becomes Division Charlie, and then we have a safety chief. And we are blessed with staffing out our ears. So that's the only way we can do that.
When you say staffing, do you mean
bodies.
Companies or do you mean overhead like chief officers?
Well, chief officers also. We have a minimum of four chief officers on every fire that we have. Every residential fire, and it just escalates from there. Again, we have 4-0 staffing on all apparatus. So we show up with, again, 45 to 50 people on a single-family residential. A second alarm doubles that. A third alarm, again, and then you start half those people on each alarm after that.
So let's throw a little water in the oil here and go to Wes. Wes is... been in the fire service well over 30 years. Over half of that was as a company officer. Worked in a multitude of different systems. And that Todd talks about best practices, and this is a controversial subject because I know that I have worked for and with company officers that their opinion was, you know what? I got a battalion chief right on my heels, or I got a battalion chief a few moments out, or I have a second due company officer right on my heels. I'm going in with my people. I'm going to make a difference. And then I also know other very well-respected and great company officers that say, you know what, if I don't take command and run this, it'll take command of itself and run it, and that's not the way I want to do it. Give us your thoughts and processes on the yin and the yang there.
Well, listening to Todd and Anthony talk back and forth here and both approaches. Kind of in the middle on how we, in my department, we did this.
Mm-hmm.
We set up ICS on everything. Everything has a command structure to it for accountability, for system, for managing people, for making sure that that happens. How that happens is based on our fireground approach. We have a standardized approach to the fireground based on the incident type. Whether there's a chief there or not, our companies know exactly what they're doing by order of arrival. First in, second in, third in, first truck. They know. It's in the playbook so that there is no dice shaking anything else. Anthony brings up a really good point about the bread and butter fire. I think that's a big part of the discussion here is the routineness of a fire. Where are we killing ourselves? In routine fires.
Yeah.
Well, obviously they're not routine. And I think that is a thing that culturally we need to look beyond and realize that we're going into so many unknowns that oftentimes we underestimate or undergun ourselves with it's bringing a knife to a gunfight kind of a mentality. And that in itself is a contributing factor.
Exactly.
Is not realizing exactly what we're doing.
Yeah.
People can say ICS is a wild land thing. Sure, if you want to go the whole org chart and fill in every little box, it's quite interesting to see that on a large-scale fire. But the part of it that needs to happen is the command and control of the incident, be it a house fire, a commercial fire, you know, industrial fire, whatever. It's got to have some command and control to it. The fact that the way we approach fires has changed with the establishment of two in, two out,
yeah.
Rick responsibilities, the different standards that have come into play in the last few years. That's changed the way the fire ground has been approached. Used to be, and I remember it in my department, we have a three-person engine company, four-man truck. So we don't have the ability to have two members go inside, start the fire, attack with two people standing outside. We have to wait. In the old days, captain was inside on a line fighting fire. Hydrant person would come up and follow the line in and find the captain. Yeah. And that's how they would join back up.
He's old.
Thankfully a little. I'll get my cane.
Who tied the horse to the post when they pulled up?
You know, it was when they put rubber tires on fire rigs that it really was the problem.
That's where it got interesting.
Yeah, that's when it got interesting. But the issue is now that allows the first in officer to make some good decisions and to be able to look at the fire a little bit better rather than being the moth to candle. And because of our approach of having a very standardized approach where the engine first in engine lays in, establishes whatever command mode they're in, you know, if they're going to go do fire attack, then they say we're setting up for fire attack. They're still in command.
Right, yeah.
You know, second in engine, they know exactly what they're doing, coming in to pull the second attack line. If we have a confirmed fire, we had to add an extra engine, extra chief. So we get four in one and two chiefs. And they know what their job is. Third in engine is going to be doing whatever is necessary. Fourth is going to be Rick. And that second chief will be the safety officer. So that adds that command structure, that command and control kind of a thing. Call it ICS, call it what you want. It is that structure that needs to happen for all of the reasons that create a safer fire ground. I'm not saying that we need to safety ourselves, mm-hmm. you know, be the OSHA cowboy, but we do need to pay attention to the fact that we aren't really looking at what the problem is, and we end up in trouble in places we shouldn't be in trouble in.
Exactly.
We underestimate it, and that's a big deal. But it's cultural. It's an experience issue.
It is.
It's not anything other than we start believing our own press. And mm-hmm. I really believe that. That kills us. Or at least gets us in places we shouldn't be.
You know, we'll come back to that because I think that's a good point to come back to is that you bring about the issue of experience and that. And maybe I'm a little bit outside the box here is that recognizing that our company officers, especially the newly promoted company officers, need to capture that experience to become more successful on the fire ground. I think the biggest downfall that we're facing is our inability to provide them with the appropriate reality-based training that gives them that experience before the event. So we'll come back to that. But, you know, Tim comes from Lincoln Fire in Lincoln, Nebraska. Great group of people back there. And, Tim, why don't you tell us quickly a little bit about Lincoln Fire, and then I want to ask you, first due company officer, because you're in the streets right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, right. You know, right now you got a BC to your left, you got a division chief to your right, you got a couple of truckies, you know, beyond that. First due engine company officer, single story, single family residential structure, 1,700 square feet, compartmentalized fire in the Alpha or in the Bravo Charlie corner, heavy black pressurized smoke showing from the front door. Tell me about the department, and then tell me how you're gonna run that down.
Well, Lincoln, Nebraska, as a whole, just about 245,000 people or so. No suburbs. I live about three blocks from a cornfield, literally, but I do have a Starbucks three blocks the other way, so we're good to go there. Fire department, 290 uniformed personnel, 14 stations with 14 engine companies, and four truck companies and two on-duty battalion chiefs, and six medic units as well. And medic units are cross-trained dual role, as are some of the captain paramedics, of which I am one, gentlemen.
Sorry.
couldn't get hired just being a fireman.
No,
huh?
Couldn't get hired just being a fireman. Had to use that golden ticket.
Just checking.
Yeah. Typical staffing on paper. Staffing is four personnel per engine and truck company. However, we're often at three, but we don't ride with less than three. So I'd say fairly standard across the country. Truck companies, one of the on-duty trucks is 105-footer. The rest are 75-foot 75-foot Quints, not utilized as Quints, strictly as truck companies, but they do have that capability. So that's a little bit about Lincoln Fire. Now, I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I am a new captain. I've been a captain less than 2 years, so I am still learning a lot of this stuff. And I guess, fortunately for America, but possibly unfortunately for me, is it's difficult for me to gather that experience other than through reality-based training, or like you were mentioning, Mike Alder, who, you know, I watch his videos pretty religiously because I think they provide a great deal of size-up information and size-up training. Typical, you said 1,700 square foot, single story, single family dwelling, wood frame in Lincoln. That would get a response at 3 engines, 2 trucks, 1 battalion chief, and a medic unit. As a first in engine arriving officer, per our department policy or management policy, we initiate the incident command system, and per that management policy, if there's nothing showing, we go in investigative mode. But as Wes mentioned earlier, we're still in command. We may be somewhat mobile, but we'll be conducting our size up, have the other incoming units level one stage until we decide what we have so that we can commit them. Given the situation that you've given me with fire showing in the BC corner, Bravo Charlie corner, with heavy pressurized black smoke, get on location, and one of my responsibilities that I've kind of obviously delegated to my engineer, but I might have to assist him just a little bit depending on the street layout and where the fire is appropriate apparatus placement, ensuring that we have captured a water supply, or ensure that someone is capturing the water supply for us. If I know that I have a working incident, I'll definitely be capturing that water supply, though. Performing a 360 with a dynamic risk assessment, coming around the structure, seeing what we have. If we have somebody in the front yard telling us there's someone inside or whatever, that'll definitely heighten the situation if that is the case. But we're going to assume that there is someone inside. We have the option of going into what we call fast attack mode, where we're still in command until the first arriving chief gets there. But if we think that we can make an appreciable difference on the fire, we will engage our crews. Also, if we have an imminent rescue, we do have the option to forego our two out. In the case that you gave me, as an engine company officer, we're going to be pulling our first hose line. Typically, if we're riding three, we're within 35 to 50 feet of a hydrant. The driver's going to assist in capturing the water supply, but also facilitate the stretch along with the firefighter. We're going to be at the front door, and this is something that we've gotten a lot better about over the past couple of years, is coordinating our ventilation. Instead of just saying, you know, first truck company, you have ventilation, which was fairly, you know, in our past history, we say you have ventilation, and that typically meant throwing a blower in the door and seeing what happens next. And
I think we've all seen it.
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, that was we were pretty successful. But in a few cases, we had some close calls, and in some cases, didn't even realize how close we came to hurting some people. So now, because of the fact that we've had some additional reality-based training, some truck academies, some tactics training, now we will coordinate our ventilation. We'll typically assign that to the first truck company, and the truck company that is co-located with my engine company, we kind of the truck captain and I kind of have a deal. He kind of steps back just a little bit and reads a situation, but he'll also take a listen to me on what I'm seeing on the inside, and I'll tell him if I have heavy, thick, pressurized black smoke. That's cue-based communication. He knows he needs to go to the roof and do that. Whereas if I say I've got light heat, you know, laminar smoke coming out, and it appears we have a room and contents fire, he may proceed to positive pressure ventilation, but he's listening to me on the radio and vice versa, so we're coordinating that. Last fire that we had just a couple weeks ago in an apartment building, he was actually, because of the size of the structure, he actually went and performed the seaside check for me and indicated the location of the fire, and it was extremely useful for me. So that's the situation he presented me. As a new company officer, that's probably the way that I'm going to do it. And I'd say that I'm fairly accurate in that that's probably how a lot of our guys are going to do it at Lincoln as well.
Good. And you talk about a couple of things here that I think are real important, and I'm just going to open it up to the group. So any one of you that want to step in here is first thing that you talked about was understanding the command concepts. You know, oftentimes in our travels, we get a run around with some BCs. We're listening to a fire and we hear people going on scene, and they'll, you know, for sake of argument, you know, engine one's on scene investigating passing command. It's like, whoa. Who are they passing it to? You know, and I'll look at the BC and he's like, well, you know, as soon as the second dude gets there, he'll take it. Well, where's he at now? You know, that's a question. But it sounds like you guys have a good solid policy on that. The other is that you mentioned, you know, the scenario we painted, it's a residential structure, and that if they're not outside, because remember, people leave burning buildings, then the assumption is they're inside. Okay, so we want to talk a little bit about that. You talked about the DRA, the dynamic risk assessment, getting that 360. And I want to pitch it to both the captains and to the chief over here. How important is that for you and in determining whether we're in the offensive and the defensive mode, and how, what are the key things, what are the critical fire ground factors we're looking for on that? And then I want to one last one. I mean, I know it's a lot, guys, so bear with me. Is ventilation? We got to talk about it, because if we're not cooling it, we got to vent it, and that's the only thing that's going to take that fire out of alignment. So let's start off with rescues. If they're not running out of the building, they're inside. Thoughts from the group.
Well, it's not vacant until it's been searched. My rescue profile is, I'm assuming somebody's going to be in there unless somebody tells me that they're all the way out. And just because it looks like it's a what somebody would call a fully involved building, or it's not survivable, or the smoke conditions say there could be nobody alive in there. As you spoke earlier when we were teaching class last weekend at another conference, that San Diego had just made a couple rescues when the initial companies that showed up said that there's nobody alive in there. They went in and they pulled out somebody that was alive. So we need to get in there and aggressively search. We risk a lot to save a lot. You know, we're not going to stand outside. We could stand outside and do spray water in the window all day long, but when we do our secondary search and the fire's out, we start tripping over bodies. Then the public is not going to appreciate us as much as they do now. And if we think we have it bad now, wait till then.
Well, and I don't want to jump in here real quick. I think that really ties in. And Anthony, you helped me out here. I think that really ties into that DRA, because, you know, I can recall coming off an apparatus and doing that 360 on that structure. And you have that heavy black, thick, ugly cotton blowing out the front door. You can see that you got fire off the Bravo Charlie corner, and you come around that Delta Division, you pop the fence, and you're walking by and you're going, you know, why isn't there any smoke coming out of these windows? And right. It's summertime.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, hello, clueless. That's because the door's closed and that's a survivable compartment.
Yep. That's a point of opportunity.
But you know, it, because you've had a couple incidences recently,
yep.
And that's why I'm looking at you. Let's talk to that.
Well, the dynamic risk assessment's critical. It's amazing how many people will argue about, oh, I can't get a lap. I can't possibly get a lap. Really? That hard, huh? And there's a lot of ways to do a lap. And it's funny, the same guy that's probably 6'5", 250 pounds will say, I can't get through a fence. Really? Really? Wow. Last I checked, you could with your boot. Now, if you take a tool with you, like you should, I'll bet you can get through most fences.
You put a donut on the other side. You put a donut
right.
on the other side and we're hanging over through anything.
I don't need a cop right. back there.
Never seen me run so fast.
That's what we're getting. So
we got it. Now here's, but we need to spell it out sometimes. For example, if your firefighter is stretching line in the front yard, dressing his line, getting it ready to be charged, not charging spaghetti, but properly getting his line ready to be charged to stretch it out, that's 30 seconds. That's a lap. Now, The other option is, what if it's a appears to be a confined garage fire? How long does it take you to walk through the living space to the backyard, take a peek, or even clear the house while the line's being stretched? So doing a dynamic risk assessment isn't always a lap. Mm-hmm. It could be seeing three sides before you even pull up. Could be more than most people do. It's situational awareness. It's also talking to bystanders, which time and time, you have to teach that skill. You know, it's amazing when guys do the, like you mentioned, the moth to the flame thing. They get on scene. They want to put water on the fire. They know other companies are coming, so they want to beat them in. And they just bypass probably people who have some legitimate information for them, like either everybody's out or the fire started in the kitchen or the fire's in the garage or whatever. Or my child is in the back, whatever it may be. And we bypass these bystanders and don't even give them a second thought in a lot of cases.
You know, you mentioned two things there, and I think we have to acknowledge a couple of people out there that are doing a great job at trying to educate the fire service. And you talked about dressing the line. You know, Ray McCormick's out there doing his best to make sure guys understand that, you know, a well-placed hose line is the best form of survival for everybody. Yep. And the other one is, he's here at the firehouse, is Danny Noonan. You know, Danny Noonan taught me about 20 years ago. He said the same thing. He said, don't just ask the people out front where they are, ask them how old they are. And it didn't really sink in. It takes a long time for me because I grew up in Los Angeles, was that it's true. I have a 7-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old son. My 7-year-old daughter is going to hide under the bed and in her closet. And then if she gets really scared and it's a fire, she may go to the bathroom across the hall because she's going to think she's going to burn.
Yeah.
My 3-year-old son is going to auger in under the bed and maybe in the closet, and that's it. And Danny told me a long time ago, he goes, Eddie, he says, you ask them where they last saw them and how old they are.
Yeah.
He says, if they're teenagers, you're going to find them in the room because teenagers are too dumb to leave.
Right.
And I think he said that tongue in cheek, but he's right. They'll ignore the event.
Right.
He says, if they're kids, if they're, toddlers, they're going to be in the crib. If they're old enough to walk, the beds, corners, and closets. And he goes, if they're old enough to recognize the danger, go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, it's worked.
Yeah,
it's worked.
It works. I had a fire a few years ago when I was a captain, and we showed up a second in on a confirmed rescue. The first engine and fire medic bypassed any bystanders. I got there second in. While my engineer was getting a water supply, my firefighter and I were masking up to go in. I saw a bystander. And I said, are you from this house? He said, yeah. I said, where is the victim? Nobody knew. We just knew there was a victim. Well, where is he? He's in that window. Now, that tells me everything. Instead of he's in the house.
Mm-hmm.
He's in that room right there. Okay.
You can target your search.
Yeah. So from the dynamic risk assessment, that's a big piece. It's huge. You'd mentioned something. You'd mentioned cue-based communication or whatever. What I'm teaching folks at our command training center and what we're doing in my battalion is I'm setting clear objectives. I don't want any doubt. I don't want to cue them. I want to tell them. I want them to know what kind of event I need. Now, that's not micromanagement. That's the knee-jerk reaction. Mm-hmm. Well, it's micromanaging. You're telling me how to do my job. No, I'm not. I'm running a fire. For example, we had a fatal fire 4 weeks ago in a fourplex. Came in as a victim trapped en route. Good column of smoke, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Multiple calls. Victim trapped. We get there. First engine arrived. He initiates fire attack. Second, it went behind him. When the truck arrived, I said, upon your arrival, your vent group, your objective is vertical ventilation. I didn't say assess for ventilation. I didn't just say ventilate. I want he and I and the crews inside on the radio listening to know that vertical vent is on its way. I don't want any doubt. Now, why am I telling them that? Well, for those reasons. Plus, and I've asked truck cabs, I've asked the saltiest, most anti-command, anti-ICS guys in the world, I've asked them, How do you feel about getting the objective of vertical vent when you're a minute or two out? I like it. Why? Because now we know what our job is. We hit boots to the ground now. We're going for the saws right now. We know where to park. We know what we're doing. We're talking on the headsets on the route. We know it reduces the reflex time for that crew. It's not that I don't trust that captain to make that decision as well, but I'm already here. Let me save you a step, hasten the vent, and let you know I want it when you get here.
Well, you know, and saltiest—you were talking about Wes, saltiest truck captain.
I didn't want
on the West Coast, and I'm going to ask Wes because Wes is all about ICS and he's all about truck work and always has been. What's your opinion? You get a BC giving you that. What's your opinion?
That's great. I welcome that. Tell me what I'm doing before I get there and have to think about it I've already got it focused. I said something about standardized approach to the fire ground. In my department, there are specific tasks that we have made a standard operating procedure, standard operating guideline, whatever you want to call it. But we've had them for years, and that's because that way we reduce the freelancing situation. And the trucks, we have residential tactics, we have commercial tactics. Either two people to the roof, four people to the roof.
Right.
Whatever it
is.
Okay. The truck officer, even if the chief's not there, if the chief's there, what they'll say is residential vent. That's the what they're going to tell us. That's vertical ventilation. Period. If the chief's not there and the engines are operating, truck's going to work on vertical ventilation. Now, the truck officer has the ability to do the size up as they approach that building. You know, the chief will say residential vent. If the truck captain gets there, and I've done this on more than one occasion, you look at it, and it's a compartmentalized fire, first floor of a two-story house. Why am I going to the roof to open this thing up when I can do some other tactic to get the same outcome? But what has to happen is I have to tell the chief, we're not going vertical on this one because of this, this, and this. This is a compartmentalized first floor fire, no extension into the living area. It's a bedroom. Room and contents. Let us take the fan and blow it out. You know, blow it out the exit opening. We're good. As long as I make that change verbally on the radio, then they understand what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The engines expect vertical ventilation. They hear the truck go on scene, residential vent. They better hear the boots on the roof, the pounding, the saws, the whole bit, and they're expecting that lift when those saws stop.
Right.
Or back off, not stop, but just back off their RPMs. So, I mean, however you box it, it's kind of the same thing. It's how you provide that tactic on the fire ground, make it work within a command structure so that everybody has the same playbook.
Right.
And they understand this is what we're doing and this is how we're doing it. Now, the rescue thing, that's an interesting nut, okay? Because we talk about latchkey kids, seniors who don't, you know, that are house ridden kind of a thing. They don't have cars. Used to be you had this certain criteria when you pulled up, time of day, cars in the driveway. They're inside. Well, with the culture of the fire service going to the safety side of the fence in some respects, that's not always something that's dealt with. I mean, I've been told more than once, if they aren't standing in front telling you there's someone inside, there's no rescue.
Oof. That's a bad... say that in front of my house.
Not to be kidding.
Yeah, say that in front of my house.
But you know what they hold over your head is a discipline issue. If you
go
in there,
you know what, write me up.
They're going to hammer you like you're a nail in the end
bring
of a
it.
Big sledge.
Yeah, bring
yeah,
it up.
I was looking for a job when I found this one.
Well, but you have to understand, there's a difference in mindset on the individuals in the department. The aggressive ones are going to go, yeah, fine, okay, discipline me. The other ones are going to go... I'm not dealing with that. They're going to back away. So we have taken an aggressive approach, and we've had to, in many places, they've slowed that aggressive approach down because the issue is if you find the victim, you're a hero. If you don't find the victim, it's an I told you so.
Yeah.
And that's that whole what's right and what's wrong. I agree that there's so many things going on now that there's somebody in that building. I got to go in and search that building because that's what we do.
Well, you know, and I'll let Todd jump in here real quick, but I wanted to bring up one thing. And You're talking about ventilation, and Anthony talked initially about, you know, the micromanagement aspect, and I will admit, you know, if you had just walked in the station and said that to me, you know, I would have, my knee would have started coming up too. But I understand where you're coming from, which is you're just objective. It's not a task.
No,
I'm not getting into
the weeds. It's not cut a 4x4 foot hole.
It's an objective.
No.
But see what I see when we have these opportunities, and Wes and Todd, I want both of you to talk to this because Wes just came off the truck, Todd's on the truck, is you get these incident commanders, whether it's a company officer, battalion chief, whatever the case may be, that says, truck one, I want you to go to the roof and prepare for ventilation. And then you get you get this stranglehold on the truck, and they say, you know, truck one's on the roof, you know, yeah, it appears as though we need, and meanwhile, the interior or fire attack's screaming for vent. They say, do you want us to cut the hole? Yeah, go ahead and cut the hole. And then they say, okay, can you notify, you know, fire attack that we're clearing the hole? You know, meanwhile, those guys are down there starting to lip slide across the hallway. That's where I think it goes from an objective to a micromanagement.
Absolutely.
And so I'm going to pitch it back to Todd and Wes. We'll go Todd first. Is Todd, I'm the battalion chief on scene, and I say, ladder four, I want you guys to do a ground ladder package and go to the roof, assume roof division. What are you going to do?
Well, first of all, I agree that, like the chief is saying, that if he gives me an order as I'm rolling in, I'm going to definitely take that into consideration. And when I get there as a truck officer, I will do my own risk-benefit analysis, dynamic analysis, look what's going on, read the smoke. And again, with my 25 years of experience, 20 years in Seattle, predominantly all on truck companies, that all happens. And Wessel and everybody here, that happens in the first 2 to 3 to 5 seconds. You look at that, you get a snapshot of it.
RPDM.
Yeah, there you go. And it's going to be, that's right or that's wrong. If I see boiling black locomotive smoke and the chief tells me to put a blower in the front door, no.
Right.
I will communicate with him why.
Yeah.
Wrigley, I will communicate with him why that's not, we shouldn't do that. Or if I agree with exactly what he said, I will take my roof package and go up. But again, being a truck officer, they should, if he says vertically ventilate, if I need the stick, I'll use the stick. If I need a straight 20-foot ladder as opposed to a 24-foot extension ladder, I know my job. He knows his job, but we have pre-designated assignments also. Again, we talked about best practices, pre-designated assignments like Wes talked about. We're changing our whole department, pushing towards the first-in-truck company. Unless there's an imminent rescue, that first-in-truck ventilates. It is a ventilation, whether it's positive pressure, natural ventilation, natural horizontal, or vertical ventilation, and it is a well-coordinated attack. If the interior engine officer says, I have a opening for positive pressure ventilation and calls for positive pressure ventilation, I will do that. The only other time the blowers go on is when I go into the building as a truck officer and identify that there's an exit point, and then I will initiate that. But we never just throw a blower in the front door. Absolutely against everything our department stands for now. What really distresses most truck officers is the indecision of a chief or a first-in-company officer that says, ladder four, search and rescue. Ladder four, vent and search. Okay, which is it? You know, we commonly split our companies. On a residential, I'll send two to the roof, saws running, ready to go. If we put the blower in the front door and it's a oops, now we have a balloon construction, we have fire in the crawl space or the attic space, I don't want to have to back out, then ladder the building, and then cut it. As soon as I say pop the lid, I hear saws going, and they cut the hole and clear it.
Very good, very good. Tim's got a question here, but before we go to Tim, we do have some guests in the audience, a couple of the guys I actually recognize, a couple of them I think I owe money to. Our guest in the audience, welcome to the podcast, and you guys have been sitting here patiently and have heard us going off. Do you have any questions for us that we can add to the podcast and hopefully answer? No, that is a great question. And the question was, the changing fire service with the experience levels, How do we address the diminished experience levels of our personnel across the board, from firefighters all the way up through to chief officers, and that? How do we address that and continue to operate efficiently and yet in a manner that we're you know, giving our people all the opportunities to go home the next day? That'd be about the right thing. He's shaking his head. Perfect. You know, I look at the way that Colonel B.P. McCoy trained his people in 29 Palms at Marine Corps Combat Challenge before taking them to Iraq. They had never been in Iraq. Most of them had never been in war. Most of them had never been in a running gun battle. And yet, when they trained their people, they were successful in Iraq. Did they take some casualties? Absolutely. Were those casualties as a result of mistakes or miscues? Probably not. They were probably as a result of the fact that war is a deadly, dangerous, complex, organized amount of movements that we can't control everything, much like the fireground. But what we know is that when you look at the way McCoy trained his men, he trained them for war. They did not go out and in 29 Palms in T-shirts and running shorts and do their drills. They did not physically and mentally prepare themselves in air-conditioned buildings, watching videos and doing online training. They did it by doing what you do on the field. And they did it repeatedly until they were perfect at it. And they accepted mistakes. And they did not have a zero mistake mentality. But what they did was they trained to the event. And I will say the fire service fails to do that. The fire service is afraid of the guy that looks at you and whines and cries about going out and throwing ladders again. Or it's, you know, it's okay because you did a good job and we don't want to hurt your feelings. The fire service has got to stop this nonsense. We talk about RIC deployments and how we're doing this. We're going to be horrible at it. You know why? Because at no point in time does the fire service ever fully put somebody in their full PPE and make them hormonally induce their heart rate to 220 beats per minute and get them to the point of exhaustion and have them perform fine motor skills with structural gloves in a zero visibility environment, in an environment that is rapidly turning hostile. What we do is we let them go in and take off gloves and hook these fine connections up and say, okay, great, drag them out. It ain't going to happen. If we really want to prepare our people, we got to start preparing them the way we fight fire. And until we do that, we are going to continue to be witness to slaughter of our people. And that's just the bottom line. I mean, Herculets said it the best. Of 100 men in war, 10 shouldn't even be there. 80 are nothing more than targets. 9 are your fighters, and they're the ones that bring the battle to the fight. 1 is the warrior. And each and every one of us have to ask ourselves, are we the warrior or are we the 10? I personally would rather be the warrior than the 10, and that's what we need, the mentality we need to bring into the fire service. Sorry, I got all wound up.
God, you got emotional.
Wow. All right, your turn. Like,
can I hold you for a while?
He sprung like a top, and he said everything I was going to say, only better.
I'm going to dovetail off of that, give you some specifics. Pushing 3 years ago, I mentioned in the last podcast that we opened a command training center at our fire department. Modeled it after Phoenix. And we are by no means quote-unquote perfect, like Ed was saying, but we have made tremendous strides. Before the command training center, like you said, we had, and we still have, inexperienced officers who were yesterday on a fire ambulance for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Today they're on an engine, and they've probably never even been first in on a structure fire. And now they're a commanding officer, company officer. So what we did is we created a state-of-the-art simulator lab that's got 10 kiosks in it. And in addition to that, there's an 11th position out for the battalion chief. Battalion chief, we have a mock-up. There's a mobile data terminal. There's two radios and everything he would have at his disposal. He's looking at a screen. In the simulator lab, there's 10 different kiosks, and each computer screen that the 10 officers are looking at is a different view of that fire. So, for example, vent group or roof division would be seeing the roof. Interior would be seeing, you know, fire condition, smoke, with a heads-up display of a mask, for example. And what we're doing is this is a living, breathing event. So instead of everybody sitting in front of a screen seeing just the A side of the structure, there's 10 people seeing their respective views of the incident, and those respective views are being timed differently, so they're progressing differently based on the decisions they're making. While this is happening, everyone's wearing a headset. We're all on a tactical channel talking through the incident, and we take training timeouts. If somebody foobars and says, I'm going to stick this fog nozzle in the window, we stop. Okay, here's why that was stupid. And we've had knockdown, drag-out fights in the sim lab, okay, because you get two kinds of folks. You get the ones who've been there, done that, been around, been officers 10, 15, 20 years, and they're making sophomoric mistakes. And really, those truly are the ones I'm more concerned about than the new kid who's moldable, who at least knows what he doesn't know or is willing to maybe learn. The guy that bothers me is the 15, 20-year guy who's making really, really dumb mistakes because he's never been to a class and he's never learned from anything he's done. And he's making these ridiculous mistakes. But because he's been a captain for 15, 20 years, his ego is so huge that he can't physically receive training. He won't change. That's the one that scares me. But the point is we just got done this past month in February going through a round of training. And everybody, what we do is we shut an entire battalion down. And in some cases, that's 12 companies. We shut them down. We bring them into the command training center with their battalion chief. He's required to be there with them. The other companies that are on duty filter in and move up to cover their area, and they are there for command-level training. And we watch videos, we listen to case studies, we listen to incident reviews and radio traffic, we look at fire conditions, we run simulations, and we talk about building construction, we talk about fire and smoke conditions, reading smoke, sizing up, we talk about dynamic risk assessments, we talk about tactics and strategy, hose line placement, choice, etc. And we saturate these guys. And there's a lot of good discussion. And we're getting great feedback. And more importantly, we're seeing great strides operationally. Now, are we perfect? No way. I don't think any of us would ever say that. But we're way further than we were 3 years ago. The key is to not only keep that going for the incumbent officers. The key is to take those templates and those lessons learned and apply them to the new incoming officers, the ones who are taking the test. Because one thing that pisses me off is when the test is different than the real world. When we teach, quote-unquote, the test, as it were, and then we say, now that you're on the list, forget everything you studied, and here's the real way to fight the fire. Here's the real way to deal with a counseling session. That when the fire service fixes that, I'll be out of a job. Okay? Because the cool thing is, I get to go around the country and tell people, look, it is about the job. It's not about a test. It's not about check boxes. It's not about telling them what they want to hear. It's about being a damn good officer. You can't fake it. You just can't fake it. And so the idea is develop good officers and keep them and sustain them as good officers. And I think we underestimate the power of the simulation software that's available down in the showroom right now. We underestimate the power of that. You know, Sully, when he landed that plane in the Hudson, he hadn't done that before, but he simulated a lot of weird stuff like that before. Can I say that?
Beep. Yeah.
Just did.
Yeah. Just did. I don't think Matthews could edit that out.
Okay. For posterity. I hope so. Anyway, but the point is he was able to simulate it. And here's the thing. Let me give you another reality, some experience I've had with this. Before we even developed our fancy command training center, when I was first promoted to battalion chief, I had nothing more than my laptop with the software, and it was an older version of the software. It was just a little bit above the old school, you know,
sand
tables. Remember those? Yeah.
Linky doesn't. He was playing in the sandbox.
I've been there. I've seen the sand just barely though.
So, my first experience at live fire training was when I was four. My firefighter brother arsonists were lighting cardboard boxes in the backyard. I put them out with my Tonka trucks. Everything was defensive. Anyway, so no RIC teams, no medical aids in my backyard. My ISO rating in my backyard was 500. Okay. So anyway, so I ran around with my laptop, and I asked my officers, "What do you guys think?" And they're like, "This is awesome. We've never seen this before," because they are incumbent officers. The new ones were familiar with it. And so we started training. And what I started doing is bringing maybe one or two companies together, and just with a laptop and maybe an LCD projector on the wall in their kitchen, we would talk through incidents. We would walk through and talk about critical fire ground factors, talk about Bruno's functions of command, talk about this stuff. And wouldn't you know it, the fire started going better in our battalion. And one of my proudest moments was on a, it's going to sound weird, so hear me out. We're on a triple fatal fire about 4 years ago. I'm in command of a two apartments going, 6 in the morning. When it was dispatched, we were all in bed. Two babies are trapped, and their dad went back in to get them, and he became trapped with two apartments going. The first arriving officer to that was one of my guys who was actually an acting officer who was getting ready for the test, and he was sitting in the front seat because his captain was mentoring him. When he arrived on that fire, the arrival report sounded like Perry Como doing a Christmas tune. It was the most calm, concise, appropriate arrival report you've ever heard. Later on in the incident, one of the captains who was I assigned Division 2, not one of my captains, he was a callback that day, he lost it. He went fetal, and he was overwhelmed. I field promoted his engineer to Division 2 because his engineer was one of my guys studying for the captain's exam, had been through a lot of the simulations, had been through the software and the drills, and he acted as a veteran chief officer on that fire, and he ran the tactical level of that operation. And listening to him, and I remember because he was getting ready to get promoted, and he was like, "Oh, I don't know if I'm ready for the job." I go, "You want to know if you're ready? Listen to this recording." And I played him the radio traffic of him on a triple fatal two apartment fire, and it was phenomenal. And you could just see his whole body language change. He believed in himself, and he didn't even know he had the skills that he had, and it was because of that realistic based training. So I echo what Ed's saying. You look at what BP Moore did, and you look at what a lot of these really fine officers do in the military, and they don't pretend. They do it for the real deal, and it makes a difference. And we are at war with fire. That is the battleground. The battlegrounds are houses and commercial structures, multifamilies, and we know the enemy. We know the battlefield. There's no reason we shouldn't be teaching these folks, these kids, quote-unquote, who don't have the experience, as it were, how to do it right on their first time out. Will it be perfect? No, but it's a hell of a lot better than watching Xbox, hell of a lot better than worrying about, you know, your retirement that's still 25 years away. And that's what, unfortunately, a lot of guys are doing. So now I'll get off my soapbox.
Well, and your department is not the only one with that new department. We've turned over,
I'm there,
you know, 900 people in the last 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Tim, we didn't mean to ignore you.
No.
You're over here peeling some corn stalks. Go ahead and ask your question and chime in.
Well, one of the questions that I like to, or something that I like to discuss, is what does the word coordination mean to you tactically? Because if you read a magazine article or if you get on any internet forums where they're talking tactics, they're showing videos, and you get people chiming in on how they would attack a certain fire, how they would command a certain fire. And obviously coordination is a component of the incident command system. But what when you say coordinate ventilation with fire attack, what does that mean to you?
You know, I'll start off and I'll make it brief. A lot of people run around and say situational awareness. But really, yeah, I'm aware. Building's on fire. Okay. Let's take it to the next step. Let's talk about situation analysis. Okay. Situation analysis dictates that I have certain facts that are presenting to me. Okay. What type of structure is it? Whether or not I have a rescue. What is my GPM flow required to initiate fire attack? Whether or not this is content, compartment driven, or structural. Whether or not it's into the structure, what's my lost time interval? You know, do I need to capture extension? You know, I'm starting to go through the whole Revis model here. Mm-hmm. So when you ask me coordinate, I just look at Revis. It's real simple. Rescue, exposure, extension. I need to ventilate to make the building behave better than it's behaving right now because it's behaving badly. I need to attack the fire, identify, locate, confine the fire, and then I need to conduct search operations. And then everything beyond that becomes a quote-unquote support function. but I can't get any further down in my depth chart than if unless I coordinate ventilation with attack and search.
Yep.
Those are the three, in my opinion, critical fireground factors yep. that we must address primarily on the fireground before we worry about Camp Snoopy Director and all that other nonsense. And you can't run a fire by looking at a clipboard. That is checkbox firefighting. Yep. You've got to look at the fire and see what the fire is doing. And if you want a perfect example of that, Mike Alder.
Exactly.
The guy. I can listen to the guy 2,500 miles away over a podcast describing a fire, and it paints a perfect picture. You know, and he isn't looking at a checkbox tactical worksheet. So that's my opinion. I don't know. What do you guys
say? I was going to say the same thing. I was going to say Mike Alder, just outstanding. He's provided the fire service with a tremendous tool. People ask me, how can I do more of this? Where can I go online? I go, you go look up inside the command post on YouTube, turn the volume off the first time, and run it and record yourself. And then do it again with him doing it. Turn the volume up and see how you did. There's three things that we're teaching and that I practice on my fire ground for coordination. And this is right out of Bruno's world. There's three levels of operation on the fire ground. There's task, there's tactical, and there's strategic. And the key is that you got to play your stinking position. Task level is a company doing the work. That's a 3 to 6 foot sphere of awareness, sometimes zero awareness because they're in smoke. They're doing the work. Behind that, and on the other end of the spectrum is a strategic level. That's the incident commander. The piece, and we were talking about ICS earlier, because I want to kind of bring it back around a little bit here. The piece that I find often missing and the key to coordination on the fire ground is the tactical piece. The tactical piece is where you have division and group supervisors come into play. I'm telling you from experience, when I'm commanding a fire, I'll be lucky if I have a decent view of the A side or an AB mm-hmm. corner. I either have apparatus in the way, I haven't been able to get close enough because the apparatus is there. And going mobile isn't always a good idea because I can't listen to the critical transmissions that are going on, let alone listen to two radios. So I'm relying upon division and group supervisors to do the coordinating. I want, for example, on a smaller structure, I want an interior division supervisor to know I've got two engines in a truck inside representing two lines in a search team, and I want that person doing laps, looking at smoke conditions, thinking about air management, thinking about do I need another line, thinking about how long is it taking that vent group to get up there and cut the hole. He's my eyes and ears. He's doing the dynamic ongoing risk assessment. He's talking back to me. And if he's coordinating face-to-face with those companies, even if he has to click his regulator in for a minute, walk in, talk to them, and come back out, and click off, and then talk to me, he's coordinating. He's coordinating with vent group and saying, guys, you know, or looking at them going, how long is it going to take them? By looking, he might say they're going to have that hole open up in another minute, just by looking without having to ask or whatever. So to me, that's where this textbook term coordinate comes from, is your division and group supervisors. The walking boss at the tactical level is the safety eyes and ears for the incident commander and the guardian angel for the companies performing the tasks. He's the one that says, hey guys, the smoke's looking bad, get out. Or hey guys, get off the roof, it's not looking good, or whatever. Mm-hmm.
So. Wes, we're gonna bring it around the table here. We're going to bring it home real quick. You have undoubtedly the most experience of anybody at this table, and specifically come in first due on fires. If you had to put it in a nutshell, give it to us straight from the horse's mouth, what's the most important first due considerations for an officer?
I'm thinking for a second. It's probably better to engage the brain. I think some of the – you've talked about a lot of that, the critical things a first due officer has to do. The biggest thing for me is understand what it is you're about to do and what you're engaging in. If you have no clue why you're doing what you're doing, you're a statistic. It's just a matter of when it's going to happen. And the problem is, if you're an officer, is you're responsible for other people that they're going to call statistics as well. So I think the biggest thing is that a company officer needs to do, whether he's first arriving in or just how he does business, is understanding his job. or her job, understanding the craft of firefighting, understanding what their role is, understanding what their responsibilities are. That's all part of a company officer's job, is to know those things. And we as a culture, the fire service, have taken a lot of that away because we're so concentrated on other stuff that we don't pay attention to what the job is. It's like the stuff in a McDonald's hamburger. Everything else is non-meat filler. It gives us something to do in between fires. They pay us to go to fires and provide that service. The other stuff we just do because, you know, it keeps us alive, so to speak. I don't know if that's a good answer for the question, but I think it's how well-versed are you in what your job is and what your responsibilities are on the scene. And it's all the things we talked about. It's the coordination, the tactical analysis, or the situational analysis. It's understanding because you're not doing a task that others are, and you need to understand that because you're expecting certain things to happen. If they're doing their job, certain things are going to happen. You're going to hear radio traffic. You're going to hear sounds. You're going to hear the chief making given orders. And if you're not hearing that, then you're starting to think, okay, what is going on here? You know, what is... I'm not hearing anything. Did my radio die? Am I missing something?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a lot of things. It's a global thing. I can't put it into just a few words.
Right.
I think it's all in how you practice this job. And it is a craft, and you have to be good at it. And if you're not, then you're going to get what you reap what you sow.
Yep. Todd, coming from a senior ladder company officer, and that words of wisdom for people looking for first due considerations. You know, it's you're seeing the change in dynamic every day. What do we need to be thinking about?
Well, it's all about preparation. The chief, Wes has a lot to draw from his experience. The training, but you need to prepare yourself for the job. Before you ever step up and even look at the first fire scene, you need to prepare yourself from the first day. You need to mentally prepare yourself when you drive to work that day, exactly what's going to go on. Your size up, you know, we teach tactics. When does your size up start? My size up starts when I get up in the morning, I drive to work, I look who's on my crew. I know if it's a no-cut day from the first 2 minutes I'm at work. You know, I got an overtime medic, I got a trade from the engine, and our medics don't generally ride the rig, so I'm just throwing that out there. They ride a box, and they never assign to a truck. So, I mean, I show up, and I got a backup driver. So sometimes it is a no-cut day. So I mentally prepare myself. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do. You know, all the other stuff happens in the first 5 to 10 seconds you show up on the fire scene. All your assessments, your risk, you know, dynamic risk assessment, everything. I get this snapshot. I draw on all my experience. I know who my crew is. I know what my crew can do. When I show up to work in the morning, I look who's on the engine sitting next to me. I look who's on the second in engine, the third in engine, the second in truck. And I already know what the capabilities of my battalion is and my chief. Before I even sign on and put my bunks next to the rig that morning. That's how you prepare. You prepare up front, and if you're not willing to do that or you can't do that, then don't take the test, period. Don't take the test and let somebody else who cares take the test.
Very cool. Sing it, brother.
Absolutely.
All right, Tim. So as a new company officer, you had an opportunity to listen to all of us kind of go off over the last hour. What are you taking away from this? What are you taking back to Nebraska besides a tan?
Come on, you're not calling this a tan?
White's a color.
It is. It's also a mindset.
Wow, did you just say that?
I would say, well, that's what I was actually going to talk about, is the mindset that, or what I'm going to take back with me is the fact that you have to have a tactical mindset. You know, Wes talked about the craft of fire and that you have to be good. You know, Tony talked about the fact that the fact that you have to have the triangle of basically the triangle of responsibility on the fire ground, you know. And Todd brought up the fact that when he gets up in the morning, he's developing that mental size up. So I think that's really important, not just from a company officer perspective, but also from a firefighter's perspective, just having that mindset at all times. And I think that's going to get you more into the job, and you're going to be more willing to look at things from a different perspective, but also work things out in your head in advance so that helps you to make some of your decisions.
Very good. Very good. All right. Well, that's it from Firehouse Podcast Live in San Diego at Firehouse World. We are going to wrap this show up. And once again, I thank everybody. I thank our panel, Anthony Castro, SAC Metro Battalion 7, right? Tim Linke, Lincoln Fire. What engine?
Engine 8.
Engine 8. Todd Wernette, Lattle 4, Seattle Fire, and Wes Kitchell, The Craft of Fire, Santa Rosa, California. For that, it's Ed Hadfield, Firetown Training Specialist. Thanks for joining us. And any information on anything we talked about, Pete Matthews at firehouse.com will be able to provide you with that information. He'll give you links to all of us, and it's been our pleasure. We look forward to seeing you in the future, and we'll see you on the big one.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.